You're listening to Into the Light, and I'm pleased to have Robert Freeman join us in the studio now to tell us about how the women of Bach's time were treated and regarded, and especially to talk about the poet Marianne von Sigler. Welcome, Dean Robert Freeman. Thank you so much for coming to Into the Light to talk to us.
Thank you for inviting me.
I know that you've been the Dean of Fine Arts at the University of Texas since last March. You want to tell us a little bit about your where you were before then? I know you were at Eastman for a long time.
My mom and dad were professional musicians. I graduated from Harvard and took a PhD in musicology from Princeton, made tenure at MIT, and then directed the Eastman School for 24 years and presided over the New England Conservatory for three before I came to Texas in 2000. It's great to be here. Never thought I'd be a Texan, but I love it.
That's true of many of us, and we're so happy that you're here. I know there's a big buzz about it. And you wanted to talk to us about Marianne von Sigler. I understand you got interested in her as a graduate student.
During the days I was a PhD candidate at Princeton, one of my teachers was the late Arthur Mendel, who was one of the country's, indeed, the world's great Bach scholars. There was a man in New York City named Walter Hendrickson, who was the owner of C.F. Peters, who had fled once from the Nazis and secondly from the communists, lived in New York City, and had secreted within his overcoat when he came to the United States a bunch of Bach manuscripts, among other things.
Mm-hmm.
Walter, understandably, didn't like Germans, and thus the people who were putting together the Neue Bachausgabe had to find an American who would be responsible for editing the Bach manuscripts for the NBA that lived in New York City. And my teacher, Arthur Mendel, was the one who became responsible for that. His PhD seminar did some projects together, and then Arthur picked out some of his graduate students, and each of us had the opportunity to edit one of these cantatas. And mine turned out to be the piece of this evening, Bach Cantata 176, with texts by a woman who lived in Leipzig at the same time that Bach did, named Christiana Mariana von Sigler.
Now, did Bach, how did he generally pick out texts for his cantatas?
Well, he had depended on what kind time of his life he was in, where the cantata texts were coming from. In Leipzig, his usual cantata text writer was a man named Picander. And Picander did most of the Leipzig text. Actually, among the Bach cantata texts, there are nine only, which are by Marianne von Sigler.
Nine,
that's what
we're
going to talk about. Nine out of the 200 or so Bach cantatas which we have left is a pretty fair number. Spitta, the great Bach biographer of the 19th century, had as early as 1870 figured out that the nine of these Bach pieces were on text by Marianne von Sigler, and he knew who she was, and he wrote, in fact, an article about her in the 1870s, Marianne von Sigler and J.S. Bach. The nine cantata texts that she wrote are on successive occasions for the Lutheran liturgical calendar between Easter and Trinity, which is to say during the spring of the year. The present cantata that we're looking at tonight, 176, is for Trinity Sunday and is the last of the series. The other eight Sigler texts are cantatas 103, 108, 87, 128, 183, 74, 68, and 175. Your listeners will think, well, how does that work?
They're not in order.
And you should remember that the numbering of the Bach cantatas was not in chronological order as Bach wrote them, but in the order in which Breitkopf and Herdl published them 100 years after J.S. Bach's death. Spitta knew that she had written them at one time, and even beyond that, he knew that Bach had set those texts all in the spring of the same year. And the reason he knew that is that they were all not only on text by the same poetess, but they were all on paper with the same watermark, and they all involved the same kind of handwriting of his, which we're all great expert on. And, in fact, the people who wrote the parts had all been students at the Thomasschule at the same time. And we can trace all of that. So it was clear that Bach had written them in the spring of the same year. The question was, which year? Because Marianne had published these nine texts and only these nine texts in a volume of miscellaneous poetry in 1728 and had said in that volume in the introduction that she hopes someday somebody will set her text to music. Spitta thought, well, these could not have been set already in 1728. It must be after 1728 that Bach had written them.
Right. Are we to assume that Bach knew her, or not necessarily?
There are only 50,000 people in Leipzig, which is a fairly small town, and there is a poem which she published in 1729 in which she said that Bach was as good a composer as Handel, who was, of course, an internationally distinguished figure at the time. Mm-hmm. So here we have a local poetess saying that the local composer is every bit as good as any composer then existing. So one would suppose that she and Bach knew each other. Mm-hmm. It's a town smaller than current-day Victoria, Texas. And it's not to be imagined, I think, that she had written these nine texts, that he had composed them to music, and that she didn't know about it.
Right.
So Spitta looked at 28 and thought, well, they hadn't been done yet. And 29 and 30, the church was closed. And 31, he had a specifically dated piece that was in the spring of one of the years. And there were other problems with 32, 3, and 4. So Spitta ended up putting these nine texts in 1735.
Right.
And that went along with the basic idea that Bach was a typical German, that he was a distinguished Lutheran, and that early in his life he had committed himself to writing lots of church cantatas, which would, in the long run, form a unified Lutheran liturgy. Then it turned out, the first year I was a graduate student, and this is what really shocked people and got me all upset, that two German scholars working independently of each other, Alfred Dürr and Georg von Dadelsen, published a new chronology for the church cantatas of Bach in Leipzig. And it turned out, lo and behold, that they both agreed in all details with each other, though they had worked from different kinds of external evidence and had nothing to do with each other in the preparation of this. And they put the nine Ziegler cantatas in the spring of 1725.
Uh-huh.
So now one has to worry about how could it be, if Bach had set these texts in 1725, that she would publish something in 1728 with the text in which she said she hoped someday somebody would set them to music.
And did you solve this mystery?
Well, I thought either Dürr and von Dadelsen are wrong, and I can show and become a great scholar by making a demonstration that they had just gone off the track, that the Ziegler cantatas would reveal everything. But the more I worked on it, the more it was obvious that, in fact, they were not wrong, that all of the other pieces of the puzzle fit together, except for the fact that she says in 28 that she hopes someday somebody will set these to music. Then I found a book by a German scholar named Werner Neumann, who had printed out in columns, facing columns, I brought the book in from the UT library for you to look at, the fact that in the nine Ziegler cantatas, there are two different versions of the text of every cantata. To the degree that there are much bigger differences in the texts in these nine pieces than in any other works of Bach for which we have the published sources of the text as an independent entity. That made me wonder which was the chicken and which was the egg.
Uh-huh.
Did Bach get these texts and compose them and then she revise them? And so I put these things on facing pieces of paper and took them around to German scholars at Princeton and Columbia and Harvard and Johns Hopkins and Berlin and Munich and Vienna. And I didn't say these are texts by Bach and Marianne von Ziegler. I just say which is the original and which is the revision of the other. And they all decided on purely literary basis, without knowing anything about J.S. Bach or that he was even involved, that the version which she published in 28 was a more primitive literary version than the version which he set, apparently, in 1725. Then I learned that Bach's librettist of the 1720s, a man named Bicander, had been involved in a duel in 1725 with Mariana's poetry teacher, a German poet named Gottsched, actually a fairly well-known 18th-century poet, and that the duel had been over women's literary rights. And if you got into Gottsched, you got then some information about the fact that in those days, males thought nothing at all of taking the literary artifacts of women, which were few and far between to begin with, and simply changing them. as necessary or as they thought necessary for their own purposes. And that's what I believe happened in this case. That Bach, she composed the text in 1725, that Picander or Bach got a hold of them and changed them.
Mm-hmm.
And Bach set them to music. And then it turned out that she found out that there had been some fairly sweeping revisions, and she didn't like it.
And hence the duel.
And hence the duel, but also that's why she wrote down, she hoped someday somebody would set her text.
Her text, I see.
That if she had italicized her, she wouldn't have thrown Spitta off the scent.
Right.
But as the result of the lack of italicization, he got the whole chronology wrong. And then it turns out that the whole cultural history of Germany is different if you use Bach as a model, because the original model was every month a new church cantata.
Mm-hmm.
And that, if you believe Duran von Dadelson, turns out not to be right at all, that the pattern was that in 1723, at the age of 37, he came to Leipzig and started writing a cantata every week. And he did that for 3.5 years and then applied for a raise in salary. And the town authorities didn't give it to him. And so he stopped doing it.
I see.
If these guys don't appreciate what I'm doing, the hell with it.
Can you tell us anything about how the women in Bach's household helped him, or his children for that matter, in the massive amounts of work that he produced?
Well, you'll remember that Bach had two wives, with each of whom he had a fair number of children. The usual routine would, this was a very productive place in terms of music as well as children, and the children and the wives were involved with the students in the Thomasschule in the production of the manuscripts. So Bach would be busy early in the week, one supposes, if he's writing a new one every week, that on Monday,
really
Tuesday,
amazing.
Wednesday, he's writing a new cantata. And while we don't have official dates, I think most scholars imagine that along about the middle of the week that he would finish the piece for next Sunday, and that Anna Magdalena would then get the score and would be in charge of the copying of the parts, some of which she'd do, some of which the children would do, and some of which the students at the Thomasschule would do.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you have three first violin parts, you can take one out of the score, and then you give the first violin part to one of the students, and they, in the days when there was no Xerox machine, they would copy out by hand the second and third first violin parts from the first one. That, however, leaves you with a problem, which is going to happen often for somebody like Bach in the 18th century, and that's to say, if you're going to do the St. Matthew Passion in 1727, 1732, and again 1735, these are big pieces and big scores, and you are going to run into situations where you can use the same choruses and the same recitatives, but because you don't have the same students anymore, the great oboe player graduated,
right,
and now you've got a less than adequate oboe player or a less than adequate soprano, that you have to make up a new aria, which goes as the third aria in the first part. And so Anna Magdalena will copy out the insert, both for the parts. Now the question then comes, how do you insert the insert? The obvious way to do that would be for it to be glued over the old aria. But if you're as smart as Bach was, then you understand that doing that will make it impossible for you 4 years further down the line to perform the original aria when once more you have a very good young oboe player.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't want to. There's no staple machine, and you certainly don't want to use glue. So what you do is to have, presumably, Anna Magdalena sew the inserted piece over the old one, and since there are no sewing machines, she makes unique needle holes every time she does the stitching job.
That's fascinating. I was a graduate, like a fingerprint.
Yeah. When I was a graduate student, we used to carry around, this is 40 years ago, big suitcases full of tracing paper, because the job was always to make tracings of the needle holes in Washington and compare them with the tracings of the needle holes in Berlin or Marburg, and then you could see what had been sewn to what.
That is just
amazing.
And
so we had big concordances of all of that kind of stuff, which has very little to do with music, of course, but has everything to do with figuring out what order they were written in.
Musicology, detective work, it's really fascinating.
That's what it is.
Well, this is wonderful to know about, and I'm eager for us all to hear this beautiful cantata now. Can you tell us something about the text or read a little bit of the text?
Well, I guess I can read you an English translation of the text. The first movement is a verse from the Bible, which is, "There is a daring and shy thing about the human spirit." That's not by Mariana von Siegler. That's simply taken from the Old Testament. Then there is a recitative, the translation of which is, "I think it very shy that Nicodemus day by day come not by night did Jesus face. The sun was forced one day for Joshua so long to stand in place until at last the victory was fully won. Here, though, did Nicodemus wish, oh, would the sun now go to rest?" I didn't make that translation, but it's the one which appears with the recording that we're going to play in a bit. I don't think you want me to read all of the text of this. There are altogether, it starts, there are six movements. It takes 13 minutes altogether.
Most of which was by Marianne von Siegler.
Yes. Oh, but you can imagine how Marianne liked this phenomenon, if what I was maintaining is correct.
Right.
Here she had written this text. She had had the thrill of seeing Bach set it. And when she sits down in church, she recognizes that it is not, after all, her text.
That hurts.
Somebody is mucking around with her words.
Right.
And that's the real point for your program on women composers. It's only in the last 50 years when women have really had an opportunity to take part in this kind of creation that young women will have role models who are older women. And that leads to all kinds of wonderful things, which is what your program is about.
It is indeed.
But in Mariana's day, that wasn't possible.
Right. Well, we thank you so much for coming and talking to us about this. It's fascinating, and we're going to make an exception to our women composer sort of rule or format and play this wonderful piece by a man, Johann Sebastian Bach.